reached the point where I would look in the mirror and I don't know who I am anymore. It was a really tough road. It seems like such a small thing, but it's something that I carried with me. It was a weight. I talk about it sometimes as liberation, like that feeling of liberation. And so the word liberation comes from Latin, and it's the same as the weight of something is like, how do you say a pound in Spanish? Is una libra. So libre means free, libra means a pound, and they're actually related and they come from the same concept. And so the idea of true liberty and therefore freedom, the idea of true liberty isn't one of having no responsibility or having no weight to carry. Liberty is having the freedom, the ability to choose what weight is yours and what weight you can put down.
Welcome to the Seven Hats Podcast. My name is Yuval Selig, and I've been on the entrepreneurial roller coaster for over 20 years. I've experienced it all throughout my journey, the grind, burnout, failure, and ultimately, success. The turning point for me was realizing that building a successful company is meaningless if you neglect the other significant areas of your life. So today, I'm inviting you to join me on an adventure through those seven areas, what I call the seven hats. Every week, my guests and I will drop valuable insights and pearls of wisdom, helping, motivating, and inspiring you to get your seven hats in order and deliver real impact with meaning. So let's get going. Hey there, Seven Hatters. I'm beyond excited to introduce today's guest, Dr. Paul Rivera, a first-generation Latino and the co-founder of Be Act Change, a purpose-driven movement that's transforming the lives across marginalized communities. Dr. Rivera is a dynamic expert with a wealth of knowledge and experience spanning academia, diplomacy, economics, and coaching. His journey is a true testament to resilience and reinvention, and in this episode, we're diving into Hats 1, 3, and 6, The Soul, The Servant, and The Philanthropist. What's truly remarkable about Dr. Rivera is his unique perspective on the broken promises of the American dream for Latinos, the redefinition of Latino masculinity, and the mental health challenges around people-pleasing and overthinking. He combines research-driven insights with personal experiences to help others break free from cultural constraints and unlock their potential. If you're ready to hear a powerful story of self-discovery, service, and unshakable purpose, sit back, relax, and let's welcome Paul to the Seven Hats. Hey, Paul, welcome to the Seven Hats.
Hi, Yuval. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, listen, Paul, I'm really excited to have you here today. I've been following your work and impact, and it's clear that you have an incredible depth and purpose, from your early days as a professor to leading Be Act Change and working in high-stakes environments. Your journey has been nothing short of inspiring. And what really stands out is, in my opinion, your dedication to empowering marginalized communities and guiding people towards their true potential. You know, even in the face of immense challenges, I know you got so much wisdom to share with our Seven Hatters today. But before we get into all of that, all the meat, I'd love for you to start by giving us a bit of a background on your journey that shaped you into who you are today. So we start every episode with, where were you born and how was your childhood like?
Awesome. Thank you. It's such an honor to be here. And I'm a huge fan of your work. So it's really an honor and a pleasure.
Thank you.
So I was born and raised in Los Angeles from a Mexican mother and a Salvadoran father who met in the United States, actually. They both sort of immigrated separately and they met in the United States. And they met because my mother's father and my dad's older brother worked in the same factory. So that's how they met. So on the outside, my childhood was great in a lot of ways. We were, as opposed to a lot of sort of immigrant families, we were always okay for money. My parents invested in real estate in Los Angeles in the, you know, in the mid late 70s. And so they have done a good job of accumulating some wealth for themselves, even though we were often relatively cash poor because they invested in real estate, right? Mm-hmm. And, you know, they were pretty supportive. They were It's hard to explain because what's come out in my late, you know, several years ago when I was in my late 40s was that my parents actually hated each other all their lives and that they covered up everything, specifically my mom. My mom is, and I say this not in the TikTok sense, but in the clinical sense, my mom is a narcissist, and my dad, who loved her, covered for her always. And so they kind of did that to, I think, shield my sister and I from the reality of life in a lot of ways. And in some ways, it's appreciated because we were on the outside living a fairly normal and seemingly happy life. But the problem is the seemingly, because it wasn't real. And so there was always a lack of genuine affection. There was a lack of genuine support. You know, so it's just it's such an interesting thing to find this out about your parents as a grown adult, you know, in your late 40s, and then retrospectively analyze your childhood and remember all those moments that seemed so tense. And mom was just sort of making a happy face, you know, and trying to make sure everything was okay. And then you realize that it was all fake. And that's really the hardest part, that there was a deep lack of authenticity to my household growing up.
How did you find out?
Oh, it's a terrific story, actually. It's a pretty deep story that I've never told in a forum quite this public. But I live outside of the US. And so several years ago, I call my mom on a Sunday, as I would, and she's crying. And I said, "Mom, what happened?" She said, "Your father hit me." And man, you'd have to know my dad. Yeah, that doesn't sound like dad, you know? And I said, "Well, what?" And she said, "He's in jail." I'm like, "What?" It didn't make any sense. The story is that my parents had not basically slept in the same bedroom for about 27 years. My mom slept upstairs and my dad actually had a bedroom in the garage that he created for himself. And, you know, mom always said, "Ah, ha, ha, your father snores," and blah, 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 right? It turns out that my mom periodically would have these sort of episodes, go on rampages. And so he made that his bedroom so that he could run in there and lock the door and not have to sort of deal with her in some sense. So they had an argument of some sorts and my dad was running out. It's a detached garage. And so he was running outside to go back to his room. And it was one of those very few days in Los Angeles when it was raining. Mom catches up to him and starts hitting him. And I mean, you can't really see me. My dad is built like me, so fairly broad-shouldered, robust guy. And my mom is really slight. Dad held out his hand just to stop her from hitting him any further. She slipped on the wet pavement and she broke her wrist. My dad actually then called the ambulance. The ambulance came. They said, "What happened?" They see a woman injured and the man there. They said, "What happened?" My mom said, "He hit me." So he's my 70-something-year-old diabetic dad was immediately arrested and he was put into LA County Jail. He ended up being there for about a week almost, which is, it's a whole other fascinating story. I mean, we had absolutely no experience with the legal system at all. And you just disappear into the system. It took 3 days just to find out where he was. You know, just a phenomenal thing. And My dad is the youngest of six brothers whom, when I was a teenager, my mom decided that his family was a bad influence on everyone, especially him, and she basically made him choose. It's them or me. And so he chose to keep his nuclear family together, and for a good, you know, 30 years of my life, I had no contact with my dad's side of the family. And several times when my mom would be apparently very angry at him, I remember my dad saying to me, "You know, on the day that I die, don't tell my brothers. I don't want anybody there from my family." And he said all of that to reassure my mom. My sister picks him up when he's finally released. And the first thing he says is, "I never want to see her again." And the second thing he says is, "I want to go see my brother." You know, and it's just such a heartbreaking thing because you realize that everything that he had done was to cover for her and to try to keep his nuclear family together. And then from there, it's just been, you know, a rainstorm of stories and just sort of recalling the past with dad and understanding mom so much better for who she is, because it's constant gaslighting and inability to take any sort of responsibility for any situation that's ever happened. You know, we've tried doing therapy together with my mom, and her whole purpose in the therapy is to try to make the therapist understand that I'm wrong, or that my sister is wrong, or that my father was wrong, and never circle back to her, you know? So that, just that whole process over the last 5 years of reanalyzing and reassessing and getting to know each other in a so much more authentic way. And at the same time, no longer really having a trust, right? Because you realize that the childhood that you had growing up on so many levels was fake, you know? So it was just a really fascinating whole process to go through. And at least from a childhood perspective, the one saving grace that I had was actually my grandparents. My grandparents, they were my mom's parents, were my saving grace, because they were the ones who brought genuine love and authenticity and genuine support into my life, which I didn't have directly at home. And fortunately, we were very, very close. I saw them, you know, almost daily until the time I was about 14 or 15 years old. So they were a very big part of my life. But they were the ones who were, it's so fascinating to look back on it now, because to recognize the difference between, for example, my mom's love, which she means it when she says it, but she means it because it makes her feel good, as opposed to my grandmother or my grandfather, that was a love that was so genuinely giving. And you realize that difference between the intent of the love, if that makes sense, you know? So really, you know, I'm so thankful for having had them to be that example for me, because especially as I've grown older, and, you know, as I made my own mistakes, like my first marriage was someone who was basically very much like my mom, you know, because I grew up understanding that that's what was normal. That's what was correct, to have a superficial kind of love and a kind of support, like that my dad had put himself in the position where you sacrifice all of yourself, you know, for that other person. So it was, you know, the childhood question is a complicated one for me, because there are so many levels and so many layers that were in childhood, but didn't really get unpacked until so much later, you know?
Any siblings?
I have one younger sister. She's 2 years younger than me.
And how is she coping with all of this?
I would say much less well than I am, in some sense. She's amazing. She is a great entrepreneur, actually, and has created a great life for herself financially. But she's, for one, she lives still in Los Angeles. So she's much more exposed to all of that dynamic. And so, whereas I have gotten to the point where I accept that situation for what it is, and the people for who they are, and I've created the boundaries for myself that sort of protect myself and my life and my family, she still harbors a great deal of anger, I would say, that she's still working through.
It's interesting. Great story. I think that so many can relate. I don't think you're unique in this sense. I have portions of it in my life, growing up with my parents, their dynamic, their relationship, them staying together for whatever reasons they stay together.
Right.
And when you become self-aware of your situation, you look at life as, well, it's really what I make it out to be. Because if I lived a life that was perceived one way, and it turned out to be completely the opposite of what I perceived, then I lived a life of my perception.
Right.
And so that gives you the power and the freedom to understand that your perception is your life, which is interesting. And I think a lot of folks still live where they believe that what they perceive is the reality.
Right.
Their life, and it might not be. So growing up, what was the dream for you? What did you want to do?
Oh, man. Well, I think the best way that I can answer that question is by telling you about my childhood hero. Mm-hmm. One of the exercises that we do now with our clients is working on them to understand their childhood influences. And it's really important. And I had such a struggle to think about, because now that I think about it, you know, in one sense, it was my grandfather, you know, but that's not really what I meant by it, you know. My childhood hero was Jacques Cousteau. And I don't know if you and your listeners are familiar, but Jacques Cousteau was a French sailor and explorer. He was the inventor of modern scuba. Mm-hmm. And he had the TV show on in the late 70s and early 80s that I never missed it. And he would be on his boat, the Calypso, with the crew, and they'd be all over the world and they'd be exploring the depths and the whole thing. And I loved it because he was smart. He was super passionate about what he did, you know, and they were always doing these adventurous things, and there would be problems often as that kind of work goes. And he always dealt with it so calmly and so systematically and, you know, attacking the problem. But what I really loved was when he would go on to shore and he would be relating to the people, and it didn't matter where in the world they were. He always had such a human side to him. And he, if you've ever seen him, he was a very slight, thin French guy. And yet, because of his confidence and his passion and his certainty in himself, he exuded a masculinity that I had never seen before. Very, very different from the Latino masculinity that I grew up around, you know? So he was my idol. And so the dream for me, honestly, was to kind of get out. You know, I wanted to do something different. I saw the life that I had around me, and I wanted to do something different. It always felt very small in a lot of ways. So, you know, I was the first gen college student, and I loved school. I loved learning. So I went all the way in school, which was in itself, in my family, an act of rebellion. You know, I've traveled at this point in my life to, you know, 118 countries, and that was always my dream also. And I can kind of tie that back to my early vision of Jacques Cousteau going around the world, you know. So my vision was basically for myself to do something different with my life. I knew that I wanted to be a sort of somebody who works with their brain, their skills, their words, as opposed to the sort of manual labor that was around me, which I have such a deep appreciation for, but I know that that's not my passion and that's not my real skill, you know? And then I wanted to make a difference in the world. And that was something that was also very, very different from the upbringing that I had. You know, my family was so embroiled in its own turmoil and drama that there was very little room for empathy outside of the household, you know? And so like, as I think about the seven hats, you know, there was very, very little room for the philanthropist in my household and in my family, yet it was something that's always been innate in me and something that I wanted to bring out. My family, there was very little room for the entrepreneur in my family, the risk taker, the one that was going to, you know, do something outside of the norm. And yet that's what I always wanted to do, you know? So my dream was really to sort of push on those levels. And that's what inspired me, one, to become an educator. I was a professor for a long time, serving primarily first-gen Latino students in California. And I loved it. I loved it. It was such great work. But from there, I kind of wanted to have a bigger impact. And that's what led me to leave academia. And I became a U.S. diplomat serving overseas. And it was an opportunity for me to basically expand the scope of the impact that I could have on people, on communities, and all of that. And finally, as you said, it was the inspiration to leap into entrepreneurship, because I realized that even within the system, there were things that I couldn't do that I could do on my own. And it was really that impetus to jump into entrepreneurship and do that work myself.
Awesome. Let's tap into that interesting journey of yours. When you were a professor and department chair at CSU Channel Islands, those early academic experiences did shape your understanding of leadership, I'm sure, and potentially how you found purpose in your life as an entrepreneur and as someone who mentors others. Can you tell us a little bit about that journey and what those academic years, how they helped you in your current journey right now?
It was such a fascinating experience. So for those who aren't familiar, Cal State Channel Islands is the newest campus in the CSU system. And at this point, it's 20 years old. So it's the 26th campus in the system. So it's, you know, it's California. There's hundreds of thousands of students. And this particular campus, however, it's just north of Los Angeles, in between Los Angeles and Santa Barbara. So it's a beautiful location. And it's the closest that you can get to sort of a small private school type education within the public school system. And so I'm founding faculty there. I arrived there the year that the school opened.
Wow.
And so I got to do something extremely unique in the academic world, right? That's so few people who get to be founders at a university. So even today, 20 years later, I can open the academic catalog for the school and I can see my words. They know that this is the course I created. This is the major that I created. And, you know, these are the policies for students that I helped create and all of that. And that to this day is extremely rewarding. But what was interesting was the year that I got hired, I'm the only one who got hired straight out of graduate school. So, you know, I mean, you're creating a new university. You kind of want people who know what they're doing, right? You want experienced people on there. And so by and large, they were all tenured professors already. And I was the only one who was brought in straight out of college. And it was such an empowering experience for me because it was the first time since my grandfather, but the first time in my adult life that I was treated as an equal among people that I saw as my mentors. And it was just a really empowering experience to be able to go in and have people much more experienced than me give me responsibilities that were extremely important, to consult with me on things, you know. And it was especially those first, I would say, 4 or 5 years when the university was still launching and everyone had that entrepreneurial spirit where, you know, we're doing this together. We're doing it for the first time. It's potentially risky, but we have a vision and we're putting it together and creating the steps to put that vision into reality. And it was, I loved that. And then I loved that we were serving an underserved population. It's in Ventura County, which is at the time the largest county in the state of California that did not have a public university in it. And there's a very, very large Latino, very, very large first gen population there that was being dramatically underserved. You know, it's a population, for example, where a lot of the students want to go to college, but they either don't have the finances to go to the local private schools, and they don't necessarily have the wherewithal, for example, to go out of state or go to another part of the state. They kind of need to live at home. So they, without this university, they were kind of stuck. So such a rewarding part of that whole experience was getting to do the outreach and getting in touch with the community and all of that. So that definitely inspired my love of wanting to continue that kind of community level impact in the world. But also, I don't know, so many angles to talk about it, you know, like one of them is listening. Such a big part of the work that I did as a professor, as a diplomat, and as an entrepreneur now really involves listening, because my work is helping people find sort of their mission, vision, and purpose and create the roadmap to live it, build the resilience tools to keep going. But all of that starts with listening to what is it that this person feels inside? What's that little voice inside of them telling them? What are the things that they fear? What are the tools they've used to overcome their fears? And all of that, that listening is so profound. And it really started for me with those community conversations in terms of trying to get Latino students to come to the university and talking to their parents and their grandparents who had so many reservations, you know, about this seems too risky and this isn't really for people like us. And, you know, we're just going to stick to what we know kind of thing. You know, it was really inspiring them to say, you know what, your kids are amazing. You came to this country for your children to have the opportunity. And this is the opportunity that you came here for. So let's do it. You know, it was a great time in my life.
The sense of purpose is so prevalent in your voice and in the way you speak. One of the few that it just oozes out, just purpose oozes out of your aura. Was there ever a time that your sense of purpose was tested? And if so, how did you push through that struggle?
So what you have to know, like during that whole time, my life was very bifurcated. My professional life was amazing. I loved it. It was tremendous. My personal life was on a different level. At that time, I was still married to my first wife, and we had two small children who are amazing, amazing humans. But she and I never properly developed the capacity to communicate with each other openly and honestly, you know? And as I think about, for example, as I mentioned, my whole history, my past, my whole family story is about not communicating openly and honestly. So I understand now that I brought that into the relationship. Mm-hmm. And she had her own traumas too, you know? So when we came together, we were not a couple that was going to really work well through our challenges and our problems and our issues. So because of that, every step towards my own purpose felt like a betrayal of her purpose because we weren't aligned in our legacies and where we wanted to go in life. And so it was actually a really tough time also in that sense, because everything that I wanted to push and advance on and progress felt like it was not just a sacrifice for her, but that I was almost attacking her purpose and her legacy. And I had the example of my dad, who completely sacrificed himself for my mom. And so I started to do the same. I started to sort of let go of my vision and let go of my dream. I backed off. There were, you know, if you're familiar with academia at all, I went almost 4 years without actually having a peer-reviewed publication, which is the currency of academia. And I did that because I was supporting hers. You know, I was supporting her career and supporting her research and all of that. She's also a PhD professor. So that started to spiral me, right? Because I got to the point where I realized that I had an inner voice, an inner calling, and that my actions, my behaviors were not aligned with what was inside of me. And you justify it, right? You justify it because you say to yourself, I'm doing this for her. I'm doing this for my family. This is something that's going to be good for us in the long run. But the truth is that every time you sacrifice yourself that way, you lose a little bit of yourself.
Yeah.
And I sort of reached the point where I kind of would look in the mirror and I don't know who I am anymore. Like I really started to lose my identity, my sense of self as a Latino, my sense of self as an academic, my PhD is in economics, as an economist. And you really start to question your value and your worth to the world. And so I decided to apply. I had a sabbatical year coming. I decided to apply for a program that is the American Association for the Advancement of Science. They have a program that brings academics into government service. And it's a very, very competitive, very prestigious fellowship that I had the good fortune to be accepted to. And it was in Washington, D.C. So I had to be in Washington, D.C. for a year. And honestly, it was having that space away from the situation that gave me the time to reflect that I never gave myself in the day-to-day. Because when you're in that, on that path of misalignment, your planning horizon becomes very, very close, right? You're not thinking about next year or 5 years in the future. You're thinking about how am I going to get through today? How am I going to get through tomorrow? You know? And once I was sort of physically separated from that situation, I had the opportunity to really reflect a little bit and I realized that the extent of misalignment, because I ended up being surrounded by people who were much more aligned, much more supportive to me than the person I had been with for, you know, at that point almost 20 years, you know, and that I had a passion for that my skills were not just in teaching and economics, and that I had a much broader array of core skills that it could be applied in so many things. And I sort of remembered my desire to do things internationally and all of that. And it was just sort of a revelation is not the word, because it's not like there was a shining moment, but as you start feeling the weight gradually coming off of you, you kind of sort of come into the sun all of a sudden and you go, oh man, this is who I am. This is who I've always been. And it's sort of that sigh of relief of your identity coming to light and your outer behavior starting to match what's inside of you. You know, it was a very, very, very difficult time, because then it was the undoing of everything that I had created, right? The undoing of my marriage, I ended up leaving academia and all of that, you know? So, and it was a very, turbulent time. It was a risky time. However, I use the word risk very loosely there because as I think about my life then and what I thought and what I felt, I honestly think that the biggest risk would have been staying in that day-to-day situation and losing myself completely. You know, I was in my late 30s and already starting to exhibit physical symptoms because your body knows even before your brain knows many times. You know, I was starting to exhibit physical symptoms of a man who was at least 20 years older than me at that time, you know, and yeah, I joke about it sometimes, but I almost think that had I stayed in that situation and I don't mean just my ex, right? I mean, but just that whole situation that I was in where I felt misaligned and I felt small. I'm not sure that I would be alive still to be having this conversation with you because that alignment was really starting, that misalignment was really starting to affect me personally, physically, my sleep, my heart, everything was starting to go wrong.
It seems like there was a lot of self-reflection there. What did you learn about yourself during that time?
I learned a lot of things. I learned that I am a people pleaser, that and it's good and bad, right? That I derive joy from helping and pleasing those around me, but that I have the tendency in me to do that to an extreme where it's possible for me to lose my own sense of self and to even sacrifice myself for that. And that's a challenge. I learned about myself that my gift is to be really two things, to be a safe space for people, to be authentic. And that's something that I really treasure and that allows me the gift to see in others their greater potential that they often don't see themselves. So it's a really fascinating thing to realize about yourself because it means, for example, that I absorb the energy around me. I absorb the energy of those around me. And so this is the extent to which. So I wear, I know your audio listeners can't see it, but I wear a necklace of black obsidian because black obsidian is intended to basically absorb that energy and protect you, right? And so one of the things that I've learned about myself is that I have this energy that attracts the energy of others. And that's amazing because it gives me a gift that I can give back to others to show them the greatness inside of them and to show them the potential that they don't see themselves. But at the same time, it comes with their weight also, right? And so I have to find ways to protect myself too. And that's the seeker in me also, right? That's the part of me that needs to engage in a certain level of spirituality and reflection to be able to protect myself so that I can better serve the world, right?
These are all golden nuggets. I mean, so many, I can just imagine how many are relating to your story because it's all about relationship with yourself and relationship with others and that intertwining of principles that are so prevalent, like a people pleaser, but yet staying in a toxic relationship. And it's that ebb and flow and the turmoil that folks just stay in for so long.
Yeah.
And I think your story is going to resonate with many. There's one that I hate to make you repeat because I know you repeat this story probably in every podcast. But I remember hearing a story about dance and how you avoided it for a long time because of
very
shame.
Long time. Yeah.
Can you? I just thought it was it's a great moment. Can you share about a little bit about that time? How you eventually
found
your way
for
back
sure.
And all of that good stuff.
Man, so I have an aunt, she's my mom's younger sister, and she is exactly 10 years, just a little over 10 years older than me. You know, in Latino culture, when a girl turns 15, they have a quinceañera, right? Which is sort of their coming out, it's whatever. And so I was 5 at that time, and we were preparing, you know, it's a big deal in the family, especially if you've, you know, done okay financially, you know, that you throw a big party and whatever. So part of that is the dancing. And so I was her dance partner. I was my aunt's dance partner practicing. You know, this was 1977, you know, so we were listening to disco records. And I remember being in my grandparents' living room, and it was one of those huge consoles, right? It looked like a dresser almost. And that was where the record player was, and it had lights and the whole thing. And my aunt and I would dance, and we would have a great time, and I loved it. And then one day, my grandparents' house was always full of people. They were the most social people that I've ever met in my life. There were always people coming in and out. We're there one day, and this friend of my grandfather's, who I don't remember who it was, but he comes in, and he sees me and my aunt dancing. And he comes up to me, and he says, "Qué bonita te ves bailando," which in Spanish means "you look so pretty dancing." And he used the conjugation that implied that I was a girl, right? And that's all he said. He kind of snickered and walked off. But I was there. My dad was there. My grandfather was there. And I saw my dad's face, the shame on his face. Nobody said anything to the guy, you know, and I was absolutely mortified. I was just absolutely mortified. You know, I grew up in this very blue collar macho family where, you know, men are men and women are women. And, you know, I remember at my grandparents' house, even the physical separation, you know, the women were in the kitchen and the men were in the back in the garage. And, you know, you were one or the other, and you didn't really blend that. And that sort of image of masculinity was really, really important. And to have understood, and think about it, I was barely 5 years old, and to have understood that that was incredibly important and that I just violated that was mortifying, just absolutely mortifying. So needless to say, I stopped being her dance partner, but it was to the point where I basically never danced again. From that point, I didn't dance for another 35 years until I met my current wife, my second wife, Esther, who's amazing, and she happens to be a competitive salsa dancer, you know? But, you know, and it was working with her and unpacking that history of trauma, you know, of starting to redefine what masculinity is and starting to do something, again, authentic to me has been a journey. And that's been a really tough one. You know, it's been a really tough one. I'm still an absolutely terrible dancer, but the unburdening myself of the childhood shame has been really liberating in a lot of ways and infuriating in some ways, right? Like you said, that life is perception, you know, and that's the perception that I carried for so long. And I realized that the one who missed out, the one who was, you know, that because of that perception, I missed out on so much fun in my life, you know, and I missed out on sharing my authentic self with so many people and in so many different occasions. And, you know, wisdom comes and growth comes, but it was a really tough road. It seems like such a small thing, but it's something that, you know, that I carried with me. It was a weight. I talk about it sometimes as liberation, like that feeling of liberation. And I love words. I speak a whole bunch of languages and I love words. And so the word liberation comes from Latin, and it's the same as, so like in Spanish, something, the weight of something is like, how do you say a pound in Spanish? Is una libra. So libre means free, libra means a pound, and they're actually related and they come from the same concept. And so the idea of true liberty, and therefore freedom, the idea of true liberty isn't one of having no responsibility or having no weight to carry. Liberty is having the freedom, the ability to choose what weight is yours and what weight you can put down. You know, so the freedom that came from the realization of what that whole dance episode and what that one remark from a guy in 1977 did was the freedom was understanding, you know what, that was never my weight to carry. And I got to put that down and I got to start living my life on a much lighter way. And it's been part of the transformative growth in my life.
It's okay. I'm a terrible dancer too. Just
I tell people, you know, I tell people, have you ever been to the circus and you see the bear that's riding the bicycle, the tiny bicycle? That's what I look like dancing.
Oh, that's so funny. I'm not even going to let you know what I look like. So in this, you mentioned this last story. It reminds me of this comparison culture, the Instagram culture that kids are growing up in.
Yeah.
Now, I didn't face that when I was growing up. Okay. What advice, because you've been through it, right, where you took on other folks' thoughts of who you should be or are, and it's damaging. And right now, you multiply that by a million because it's all over the place.
Yeah.
What advice do you give your students, folks you meet, who really adapt that notion of who they are and their self-worth and perception from others based on your experience? What's the advice?
I think that there's a tremendous, how do I say, that the information age is beautiful on so many levels, but it creates infinite opportunities to fail to ask ourselves the tough questions. It's constant, immediate gratification that creates just enough noise, just enough static around us that we don't allow the not only the cognitive self, but the emotional self to do its work. So there's that piece. So I think that there is, that it's really important for people to, how do I say? Like, I can't just tell people, put down your electronics, because it's not a reasonable thing to ask people anymore. However, you need to create the space for yourself that allows you to tap into your intuition and to that inner voice. And you have to create the systems that allow you to listen to that inner wisdom that you have, because that's what it is. I firmly believe that voice inside of you is not just your wisdom, it's your ancestral wisdom that's talking to you, that's calling you always towards the purpose that you have. And by creating all of these static barriers around you, you're not letting that flow. So whatever it happens to be. So for me, actually, when you and I are done having this conversation, I have a breathwork session scheduled. And for me, that is tremendously important because it's a space where that's exactly what I do. I allow the static of life to fade away and I focus in on myself, my energy, and my connection to something greater. And so if I have any advice to give people, it's basically along those lines that you need to find one, the way to listen to that inner core that's inside of you, the wisdom that's guiding you. Two, you have to see your connection to something larger and however it is that applies to you, you know. And I've had the good fortune of working all over the world with indigenous folks, with Muslims, Christians, Jews, with Buddhists, and everyone has their own language for it, but it's really at its core something that connects you to something larger and eternal, and call it whatever you want. But that connection is at the same time something that builds humility in you, but something that also makes you see that you are part of greatness. And so your job as someone who is sort of struggling through the world is to find that purpose, to connect it to that, and to be that gift in the world. And so, and that's the third thing, that there's, I think there are a lot of people who know what the voice is telling them, who understand what it is, and then fail to take a step. And people get very, very stuck in the perfectionism, in that cycle of, I'm not going to do it right, I'm going to mess up. And what I tell folks is, the smaller you can make that first step, the smaller you can make it. Doesn't matter how tiny it is, that first step is absolutely crucial. And then you take that first step and you celebrate that you took that first step. And then you take another couple steps and you celebrate that you took those steps, because you can't focus only on the milestone. It has to be all the way down. You know, my wife actually has a practice of, she has one of those calendars that she gets from the Nature Conservancy every year. And every day she keeps basically a celebration calendar. Every day she writes down in the little square something to celebrate for that day, something good that happened, something that she did that was in alignment with her purpose that day. And you realize that step by step, micro step by micro step, you look back on it at the end of the year and you're like, wow, I had a tremendous amount of wins. And you start building this habit of seeing yourself that way, of understanding what's inside of you, understanding how that connects to something larger, and then aligning your actual actions to start moving in that direction. That's the best thing that I can tell folks, you know?
I love it. Breath work, self-love, of course, that's why it's hack number one. Because without self-love, without having that belief that you are the manifester of your success, all the other hats don't matter at all, because you're going to destroy the other hats if you don't have hack number one.
That's right.
In line.
So I like that you use the word manifester, because I think it's one of those words that is overused in a almost spiritual concept, you know, yeah. that manifestation is something that comes to you from the universe. But the word manifest literally comes from the Latin, which means to make with your hands, right? Yeah. To manifest is something that you do yourself, right? You're the one putting in that work to manifest.
Yes. And again, it's all about what is luck. Right? What is manifestation? And you can say that it's being prepared for the energy that comes your way. And I believe that. I think that you have to put in the work. Can't sit on the couch and manifest.
Exactly.
And that was what The Secret was about, right?
Exactly.
The Secret came out, I don't know, 20 years ago. And everybody started believing that as long as you just believe, things will just fall on your lap. And it's not true at all. You got to work really hard. So speaking of working really hard, because this is going to be the next stage of your life.
Yep.
BEAC Change. Tell us a little bit about that journey. I believe you're co-founding it with your wife.
Esther and I, we created this together. So both of us have pretty similar backgrounds. She was born in Nicaragua, and she came to the United States at a pretty early age, immigrant parents. She went PhD, she became an academic for a little while, and we met as diplomats, and we worked together, and we did a lot of great projects together. And one of the things that we saw as diplomats was, as I mentioned earlier, the importance of listening and the lack of listening that was happening. So in the international, we worked in humanitarian assistance primarily. And one of the interesting things is that in humanitarian assistance, the government gives basically money towards a country, and then the projects that are carried out, enacted and carried out, are tend to be very cut and paste. This is the model that is supposed to work, so this is what we put in place, without really any buy-in from the local community, from the local country or anything like that. And then they wonder later why, as soon as the money dries up, the impact dries up, right? There's no continuity. There's no sustainability. There's no carry forward. So we created a totally different model where we sort of did, I mean, you call it grassroots, ground up. Now it's called localization, where you make the local community the focus of it. And you go in without any predetermined agenda, specifically to listen and talk to the communities and ask them, what are your needs? What do you see as your biggest challenges? And what do you see as your highest aspiration for what your community could be like? And then we create sort of community buy-in, and we fund that. And it's been tremendously successful, right? Because they're bought into it from the beginning, and the resources are just sort of the capital infusion that gets them going. And they scale that, and it's been tremendously, tremendously successful and rewarding. But the hardest thing of all of that process was actually getting our own people, other diplomats, basically, to listen. Because people are told that, you know, your value is as a democracy expert, or as an education expert, or as a water and sanitation expert. And so what they want to do is come in with their prefabricated solutions, not listening, right? And so we saw that this problem was so global that we started to ask people, why is this so hard for you? And they said, one, that's my value. That's what I bring. So if I can't bring that, why am I here? And two, no one's really ever listened to me. No one's really asked me what my highest aspirations are. So I don't really know how to have that conversation with people. And that was sort of this like sparking aha moment for us, you know, and we realized that our real purpose and our real value add was to help people find that in themselves, and that by finding it in themselves, they can recognize it in others and expand it in others. So that's really the real impetus and the premise behind BIAC Change. So now we work with individuals, corporate entities, nonprofits, universities, really helping them at whatever level define their mission, vision, and purpose, create the alignment to start living according to it, and to create the resilience tools that go around it. And we really follow this model that we call collective power, which is that once you understand your value, that you have a unique gift, a unique superpower that you bring to the world. And once you start to think of yourself that way and start to see it in yourself, that sort of competitiveness, that competition that we see so much in the working world starts to dissipate, and you start to see others for their superpowers as well. And so it creates an environment where people come together more naturally for collective power to create a common vision that they advance together. And that's really the premise of our business and really how we judge success. And we've had the opportunity to work all over the world. We mentor refugees, which is a phenomenal work that we've been doing in the last year or so. And, you know, refugee entrepreneurs who are, you know, they're in camps in Colombia, in Mexico City, in South Sudan, and all these places where they're in unbelievably adverse situations, and yet that entrepreneurial spirit is within them. So we work with them to help bring that to life. So it's been a really, really great journey.
That's amazing. What's the toughest personal and professional hurdles that you faced running this purpose-driven organization? And then how are they shaped your leadership style and your life currently?
I think that the toughest personal one is learning how to sell without, and I say that because I don't like selling. I don't like to feel sold to, you know, and realizing that really what we offer is, and how do I say it? that the real progress came from understanding that this is for us more, even more than a business, is a movement. It's something that we do to help people, to help communities, to especially, you know, our Latino and African American communities. And once you start seeing it that way, that what you offer is something that is making the world a better place, it stops feeling like sales. And that's been really, really good. Mm. That was by far the biggest hurdle for me, like having to meet people, and the whole concept of networking and all of that has been really, really tough. But I think I've gotten much, much better at it as I've adopted that mindset that I'm here to serve you. I have something that I know can make you better, your life better, your family better. And that's been huge. Professionally, I think the biggest hurdle has been sort of that launching phase where you have that mentality of any business is good business. And so we definitely took on clients that we shouldn't have taken on. And we realize now that we have a core, we have principles that we follow, and that it's important for us to see the alignment between that and our clients. Because when that alignment's not there, that's when you start to see the frustration. You're not getting the results that you expected. That's when it starts to feel overwhelming in a lot of ways, because you're unsure of the quality that you're providing to the client, because you're fundamentally not in alignment. So a big lesson has been learning how to say no to even really good money sometimes. But you know, if it's not right, it's gonna bite you in the butt later.
That's probably one of the top five entrepreneurial lessons that I can tell. I mean, if anyone's listening and you're an entrepreneur and you're a first-time entrepreneur, listen to Paul's advice. Do not take on business that doesn't align with your values just because there's a lot of money online. Yeah. And you mentioned something which is interesting about selling, because I think that fear in selling is within so many folks.
Yeah.
But you actually said it. You're not trying to sell someone. You're trying to serve someone. And it's right. the same thing.
Yeah.
Right? Selling means that you are providing guidance to offer something to someone that you believe in so much that you want them to succeed in. And that's a form of servitude. And I right. think that if somebody just changes their mindset into, if you don't listen to what I say, I am doing you a disservice, because I know that what I have is so powerful for you that I'm willing to go out of my comfort zone and approach someone that I don't really know.
That's right.
And explain to them why that service or product is going to benefit them. And I think that that side of sales is overlooked and I think underappreciated.
Yeah.
Because everybody's looking at the prize, they're looking at the commission, they're looking at the dollars versus the servitude and the value that they can provide somebody with what they believe in so highly. Now, if you're selling something you don't believe in, that's a different story. But as long as you believe in, and I think we're in alignment, how quickly does time fly? I always like to close out my interviews with the following question. Who did you have to stop being, and who did you need to become to manifest your current success?
Okay. That's a great question. I love that. I had to stop being my title and my position. Hmm. So it was, there was a time in my life where being called Dr. Rivera was really important to me, and or professor. And so there was a time when I was very much, I associated my identity and my value as a person and as a professional with my accolades, with my position. So I really needed to stop being that person and become the person who learns to speak about themselves in terms of their superpower. So it really became important for, it's been not just important, it's been transformational for me to be able to say, you know, I am a person who I value growth and diversity more than anything. I'm someone who, and my gift in the world is seeing the greatness in others and helping them reach it. You know, as soon as I start seeing myself in that way, that makes me sort of impermeable to the threat of imposter syndrome. You know, as an academic, you're always comparing yourself to somebody else. And, you know, was your publication good enough and whatever else, because you're creating your identity and your value around that title and that position. As soon as I start seeing myself as my superpower, my values, and what I bring to the world, all of that really, really dissipates, because I become so much more secure in terms of who I am and what I bring to any situation, whether it's a diplomatic negotiation in Haiti, whether it's dealing with, you know, a Fortune 500 CEO somewhere else, or working with community level organizations anywhere. I know what I bring and I know what I can do. And that's been revolutionary for me.
I love that. Tell the Seven Hatters what you're currently up to, how they can connect with you. What do you want them to know?
We are, both Esther and I, we are trying to do more outreach, especially to universities. Big, big piece of the work that we do is trying to really initiate this movement. And so much of the work that we've done so far has been at the corporate organizational level. And I'm trying to get really back to my roots in a lot of ways, but talking to the youth, talking to the ones who are going to be the change leaders, the ones who are going to carry this movement forward, to think about a little bit more consciously about mission, vision, purpose, about what risk looks like, about what intuition feels like for them. So we have a series of both keynote addresses and workshops that we've been doing at a couple dozen universities in the United States. And that's something that we'd like to expand on. And so we're definitely open to any of that. And then we'd also do a lot of work with corporate ERGs, primarily with, you know, sort of the Latino or the African American groups. And it's very, very similar kind of work, sort of team building sort of things. That's been really, really rewarding. We have a book that's out. The book is called Creating Your Limitless Life. And Esther's the primary author of that. And that's been tremendous. And there's an accompanying workbook that's been sort of the vehicle that has launched a lot of this. So I highly recommend checking it out. It's available on all the major platforms internationally. You can find us on our website, beactchange.com. We have a nice Instagram page that is b.act.change. And you can find me anytime on LinkedIn, most often as Dr. Paul Rivera. And, you know, we're big believers in community. We find, especially in the communities that we work with, that there's often a lack of support. So I tell anyone who's listening, you know, if you're looking for community, if you're looking for support, if you're looking for uplift and positivity, to please always reach out to us, and we're happy to be your community.
Paul, you exude the hat that I need to work on most, and that is the philanthropist hat. I admire your work. I admire someone who thinks greater than the financial rewards of what life can offer, and really truly has something to offer individuals of all shapes, sizes, etc. Not everybody has that in them, and the world needs more of you. So thank you for what you do. I hope that many reach out to you and just get to know you, because you're a wonderful, wonderful individual with an incredible heart. And I don't know you, but just the little time that I spent with you, it shows. Thank you so much for gracing us on the Seven Hats.
I appreciate that so much. And thank you so much for this space and this opportunity and for what you do. This is a service too. And so I'm so thankful to be part of it.
Thank you so much, Paul. I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Dr. Paul Rivera. Let's end today with a show segment that I refer to as What Can We Hang Our Hat On? And here is my takeaway. Reflecting on Paul's journey, one theme that really resonates, especially for entrepreneurs, is his insight into people-pleasing. This is something many of us grapple with, whether we're just starting out or leading at a high level. In Paul's experience, the cultural and personal layer of people-pleasing created significant internal conflict, but they also taught him a valuable lesson about boundaries and authenticity. For entrepreneurs, people-pleasing can be a double-edged sword. It's natural to want to deliver excellent service, to see satisfied clients, and to create a positive environment for our teams. But when that drive to satisfy others starts leading us away from our core purpose or forces us to sacrifice our values, we're no longer building a business that's true to who we are. Paul's journey shows us that setting healthy boundaries isn't just about saying no more often. It's about aligning our actions with a bigger vision and trusting that by doing so, we're laying a stronger foundation for success. What struck me most was Paul's emphasis on redefining Latino masculinity, which also has deep implications for entrepreneurial life. Paul's choice to move beyond traditional expectations, to listen to his own voice rather than conform, allowed him to lead with clarity, purpose, and resilience. For us as business leaders, this lesson is powerful. When we are clear about who we are and what we stand for, we're better equipped to face challenges, make tough decisions, and lead authentically, even when that path isn't always the most popular or the most profitable in the short term. There's also a broader takeaway here about the journey to fulfillment over achievement. As entrepreneurs, it's easy to chase external validation, to want the accolades, the revenue milestones, and the recognition. But true success, as Paul's story illustrates, comes from living in alignment with our values and our purpose. This alignment allows us not only to weather the inevitable ups and downs, but also to create something truly impactful, a legacy that serves not just our immediate goals, but our long-term vision. So, as you move forward in your own journey, I encourage you to take a page from Paul's playbook. Build a business that resonates with who you are, who you truly are. Set boundaries that protect that vision, and don't be afraid to say no to opportunities that don't align with your values. It's in those moments of self-honesty and courage that we find true growth and fulfillment. I want to thank Paul once again for joining me so that we can all benefit from his wisdom. And until next time, if you found inspiration in today's episode, please hit that subscribe button and share it with others who might benefit from this conversation.
Let's keep growing our Seven Hats community and supporting each other in the pursuit of meaningful, purpose-driven lives. So for now, I will bid you farewell and success on your journey. And until next time, my name is Yuval Selick, and I tip my hat to you.